This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a recent article titled The End of Conservatism, political writer John Judis concluded that the American conservative movement has slipped into chaos and impotence. The article was published in The New Republic, where Judis is a contributing editor. He wrote about the growth of the contemporary conservative movement a few years ago in his book William Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives. John Judis has a new book called Grand Illusion, in which he chronicles the attempts by American politicians, businessmen, and intellectuals to come to terms with the dawn and then the sunset of the American century. In the epilogue, Judis asks, where are today's philosophers and critics, the vibrant new political and social movements? Where is the spirit of experimentation, and where are the political leaders?
Well, I was making a contrast between the beginning of the century when America was a rising power in the world and the end of the century when we're a declining power and when we face the same kind of challenge of redefining who we are and what our task in the world is. And what strikes me is the contrast between that earlier period and this later period, not only between the quality of the presidents that we've had now and then. You can put Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson against Bush, Reagan, Carter, Ford, but also the quality of our intellectual life. And the beginning of the century, the time of John Dewey, William James, Thorsten Veblen. I mean, we had a whole host of innovators in philosophy, sciences, history, and now it's very hard to find the same people.
Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that people aren't reading as much as they did, or reading serious books as much as they did, and that, you know, television has dominated the landscape, and maybe we're getting pundits instead of philosophers?
I think it has to do with something worse than that. I think that when a country begins to decline economically, when it begins to lose its place in the world, it also begins to decline ideologically. That the two processes go together.
You've been writing a lot about the history of the contemporary conservative movement. You wrote about that in your biography of William Buckley and in a recent article in The New Republic. Your recent article reached the conclusion that the conservative movement, which carried Reagan to victory, barely exists anymore. You say it's dissipated into factions. Its ideas have become obsolete or discredited. What makes you believe that this movement barely exists anymore?
Well, you have to understand that there always are going to be conservatives with a small c in American politics, just that there always will be liberals with a small l and Democrats with a small d. It's a question of whether there is a coherent movement that has certain common ideas that can go forth into a battle and win a majority in America. And I think that movement, which was based largely on a militant anti-communism, and on a certain economic platform summed up in the supply-side economics of Reagan, that movement no longer exists except as a very narrow shell and as a group of competing factions.
What are the factions?
Well, mainly a lot of them are based in Washington. You have people around, for instance, Jack Kemp, who still cling to the idea of supply-side economics, but at the same time have a genuine concern about the society, about the poor in the society, and about the cities. You have a more kind of old guard conservatives represented by Phil Graham, who are mostly concerned about balancing the budget, and who really don't have this view of trying to create social harmony and of representing all the people. Then you have the religious right. They have their own agenda. And I think that you could see already in 1988, if you want to look at the kind of bitter fight that came about between Jack Kemp and Pat Robertson in the primaries, you could see there the beginning of the splintering of the movement itself and the lack of any common leader upon which they could all agree.
Of the factions within the conservative movement now, which factions do you think are behind Bush and which aren't?
I think that there are no factions really that are behind Bush. There are a number of leaders who have a vested interest in supporting him, but I couldn't really identify a movement that was behind him. I was at Pat Robertson's Christian Victory Conference a few weeks ago, and they made a big deal over how the speakers over how much they supported Bush, But when I actually talked to people who attended the conference, I couldn't find any enthusiasm whatsoever. And I think you find that in Washington, too, if you talk to the people who are officially endorsing them. Privately, they'll say that they don't care. Some of them would rather have Clinton because they feel that they need the time to regroup. So I think that there's very little enthusiasm for Bush.
What effect, if any, do you think that's having on the Bush administration?
Well, I think the effect it's had on Bush is that domestically he has never had really a program or a direction, and he's always looked elsewhere for it. And the fact that the conservative movement has itself splintered and lost any idea of where it wanted to take the country meant that that Bush himself was at a loss. The example I would use would be the budget debate in 1990. Where Bush was trying to figure out a way to cut the deficit, and where he finally got hooked into agreeing to increase taxes, which he, I'm sure, privately thought he had to do, and where the conservatives provided him really with no alternative and no alternative program. But when he did finally come out with this budget agreement, denounced him to and disassociated themselves from him. So, in effect, they didn't provide a solution. They just provided a part of the opposition. And I think that was it was at that point where it was clear that Bush really had nowhere to go domestically.
Well, how comfortable were the factions of the conservative movement ever with George Bush?
They were never. He was always a lesser of evils for them, I think. He always had the taint of being from the Ivy League and being a kind of a country club Republican, as they used to say, from the Trilateral Commission. So he was always seen in some senses as being the best they could get at the moment, but they would preferred somebody else.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Judis, author of the new book, Grand Illusion. He also is a contributing editor of The New Republic and a Washington correspondent for In These Times. You consider the current conservative movement to be about 35 years old. Why that cutoff point? What happened 35 years ago?
Well, 35 years ago was when National Review started Buckley's magazine. It's when Barry Goldwater first became a national leader. It's when it's also when Whitaker Chambers' Witness was published. It's when a number of events conspired to give this a new movement, a unity around these ideas of a communist threat. Before that, many of the people on the right, there really hadn't, there was nothing, you couldn't have found something called the conservative movement. But many people on the right were isolationists. They didn't believe that America should have a strong military. They worried about the Pentagon dominating society. And many of them were against the Korean War. And the crucial change was the recognition by the by people like Buckley and Goldwater that it was necessary to go along really with what had been a liberal program of fighting and containing communism. They just wanted to take it one step farther and actually roll back communism.
Now, what about fringy, racist, anti-Semitic groups that have been on the far, far right? Where did they fit in under this new conservative music movement that begins at about the time of William Buckley?
There always were in America, particularly in the 20th century, groups that were nativists, that worried about immigrants, that were anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, racist. What have you? What happened in the 50s, and I think that Buckley's National Review was instrumental in doing this, was that Buckley tried to create a new respectable conservatism and to weed out these groups. And there were a number of incidents during that period where he took particular steps to dissociate conservatives, first from the anti-Semites on the American Mercury, this magazine that was important at the time, then from the John Birch Society, the people that thought that Dwight Eisenhower was a communist. And later in the 60s, in the late 60s, National Review dissociated itself from George Wallace, seeing him as simply being a racist. So I think that there was this kind of attempt to create a respectable conservatism, and by the time you get Ronald Reagan and that generation, they are really products of that process.
Where do you see neoconservatives like Irving Kristol fitting in?
They come about in the 70s. Neoconservative means that they were people who were liberals. Many of them were against the Vietnam War, like Norman Podoritz. And they had a moment of conversion in the late 60s and moved steadily to the right until they found themselves in the conservative camp and supporting Reagan in 1980. Some of those people, though, have started to come back. With the Cold War's end, the basis of their own conversion has really been taken out from under them, and they're beginning to look back at the Democratic Party.
Neoconservatives are doing that, you think?
Yes, absolutely.
No, yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's happening in Washington. There's people like Josh Moravchik at the American Enterprise Institute, the columnist Ben Wattenberg. You can hear quite a few of them now reconsidering their ties to the Democratic Party because in some respects they still remain Democrats, for instance, in their support for the New Deal and for the basic idea that government has a responsibility for taking care of those who can't take care of themselves. I think that that's something they continue to share with the Democrats.
Well, how else do you think the end of the Cold War has affected the conservative movement?
Well, I think that that's about the main way it's in which it's affected the conservative movement is by removing the one basis of unity that held together all the factions. And so I think that without it, what really happened was that all these tendencies that had been suppressed, laid aside, and to all extent and purposes had vanished over the last 30 years, suddenly came back to the surface. It was a kind of return of the repressed, so that you have the all of a sudden you have the David Dukes, the Pat Buchanans, all these kind of things that really had been forbidden in terms of what was respectable conservative politics are now back.
In talking about the factionalization of the conservative movement, is there anything you could point to during the Republican convention that would exemplify the factionalization you're describing?
Oh, I think that all the battles over abortion. Now, abortion itself was never an accepted part of the Republican platform until the 1970s. Reagan himself had signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country when he was governor of California. But it became kind of a cause celeb under the idea that was a way of attracting many of these social conservatives through the religious right, particularly that happened in the late 70s. And conservatives closed rank around it. But I think now what you're beginning to see is a younger generation of conservatives that no longer hearken to those kind of ideas and that are much more liberal in their social views. William Weld, the governor of Massachusetts, is a good example of that kind of conservative. And so the debate over abortion is a very factional debate now within the conservative movement and the Republican Party, and it really threatens to tear the party apart.
My guest is John Judis, contributing editor of The New Republic and Washington correspondent for In These Times. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Judis, author of the new book Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. Why did you start writing about the history of the conservative movement? And I'll point out again that you're the author of a biography of William Buckley.
Well, I think part of the reason was that I was a 60s radical, and I had a certain interest in ideas and in movements. And by the middle 70s, I could see my side of the movement and also the liberal movement itself having pretty well dissipated. And whatever interesting intellectually was happening in American society was happening among conservatives. That's what the magazines were more interesting, the debates were more interesting. And I began to gravitate toward my reporting toward watching the conservatives. And when Reagan got elected, I wanted to figure out why that had happened and where it had all started. And that was the reason I got involved in writing a biography of Buckley.
Now, you went to the University of California at Berkeley, which in the 60s and 70s had a reputation as being one of the most radical campuses in the country. When were you there and what were you going through personally?
I went there. I left. I was one of the early dropouts from the East. I went to Amherst, and I quit after 2 years, and I went to Berkeley in 1962, and I graduated from there, and then I went to graduate school in philosophy. And I think I went through the same kind of experiences that many of the people who were kind of coming of age politically now went through in terms of the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War. It was a time of, I was radicalized during that period.
And can you point to a specific experience a few years later that made you think that the left wasn't where it was happening anymore, that the left had changed?
Well, the experience really that was the, in 1969, I'd been a member of SDS in California, and in June 1969, there was this convention in Chicago, which everybody expected that a movement and a party would finally come out of it that would march down history, and that was the convention out of which Weatherman emerged. This kind of crazy radical sect that thought that it could make a revolution on behalf of the Third World in America by breaking the windows of Volkswagens and police cars. And it was at that moment that I realized that the left, which I harbored these illusions that we were going to march forward, was really beginning to march backward, and we were in deep trouble, as indeed we were.
Now, did that change your political ideas, or did it just change your ideas about the leadership within the left?
Well, it changed my, it certainly changed my ideas about the leadership within the left. And I think for the next 5 or 6 years, I was part of an organization called the New American Movement that we tried to develop an alternative to these kind of radical politics that was much more democratic. That was based on elections rather than violence. And so I attempted for about 5 or 6 years to do that, and then I felt that the effort was, that it was really getting nowhere. And I decided that I had to spend more time reading, writing. It was at that time that I decided to become a journalist, which meant that I had to look at things with my own eyes and report what happened, even if it disagreed with what my ideological preconceptions were. And that was a very educational experience.
What's an example of a time when looking at something carefully, you had to come to a conclusion that really surprised you?
I'll have to think about that. I can tell you what my final thing that made me decide that I had to get out of the organized left was. That was certainly remember that.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was in 1976, and I was still a member of this organization. And
NAM, the New American Movement.
Yes, and we were in I was in California in the Bay Area, and we were deciding whether or not to support the Tom Hayden Senate bid. And to me, it just seems totally obvious that we should do so. And we had this heated debate. We had a convention where all the California members got together. And people were trotting out all these quotations from Lenin and people like that. And it suddenly occurred to me that I was involved in this kind of a massive game where, in order to reach conclusions that were obvious, I had to go through the detour of all these quasi-religious texts with quotations from Marx or Lenin, and this whole history of misunderstanding. And that really, it was a needless detour, and that I had to get away from that and really begin looking at what was happening in the United States and to understand better our history.
When you started writing about the conservative movement and when you started writing your biography of Buckley, were you distrusted as possibly a liberal spy?
Well, I had a lot of trouble initially convincing Buckley that he should cooperate with me. It took about 7 months. One reason was I'd done this scathing profile of him in the Progressive magazine, which besides being scathing contained several stupid errors that I could have avoided if I was more careful. And I think he was worried not only that I would do a hatchet job, but that I would screw it up. But after about 6 or 7 months, he did give his consent. And from that point on, I was able to see many of the people. But I think still, through the whole writing of the book, I did experience a certain amount of distrust.
And what about now?
Now, yes and no. I think a lot of conservatives like me because I'm one of the few people who is actually interested in their ideas. I think many reporters are not very interested in what people really think. They're more interested in who's going to win and who's going to lose. And so I think that that's probably a plus.
I want to get back to a question that you raised in your book, which is, where are the vibrant new political and social movements, the vibrant new political leaders? Do you see any movements or leaders beginning to come of age now that are of interest to you?
Well, I think that what we're really going to have to look at is what's happening in the Democratic Party. I think that's the most interesting thing now. And Clinton and the people around him, and whether that will represent a genuine change or whether it's going to turn into another kind of Carter-esque stalemate. And I think if you look at it from certain respects, when you look at it from, these are people who understand how to work government. They understand that we, at this point, that we have to do something to revive our industry. I think that's a hopeful sign. If you look at it from the standpoint of problems like the deficit, you can fall into despair very quickly.
Do you think you would ever be able to be a member of a large political group now?
I sort of like being on the sidelines myself. I prefer it, and I think I function better that way.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Judis. His new book is called Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.